Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written that you might be interested in and tell you how to access them. Over the years, I have done a good deal of writing, as time allows, to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mentioned those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. We continue our exposition of 1 Samuel in the Old Testament. We've come to the final chapter, chapter 31, which marks the transition into 2 Samuel, where we're about to go. The Philistines were fighting against Israel. The men of Israel fled before the Philistines. They fell slain on Mount Gilboa. Now comes the demise of Saul and Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. The battle went heavily against Saul, and the archers hit him. He was badly wounded. At that point, Saul, knowing that he was fatally wounded, said to his armor-bearer, "Draw your sword, pierce me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and pierce me through, and lest they make sport of me." But his armor-bearer would not do it, for he was greatly afraid. So Saul took his own sword and fell on it. By the way, there's another example in the Old Testament of a suicide. I mention that because once when I was in Israel, a guide made the point when we were visiting a certain site that suicide was something that was verboten in Israel and nobody ever committed it, in dispute of a statement by Josephus. As a matter of fact, while suicide may have been frowned upon, here's a guy who commits suicide, Saul. Saul died, along with his three sons, his armor-bearer, and all his men that day. They all died together. And when the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley with those who were beyond the Jordan, they saw that the men of Israel fled in battle. There was rout. They saw that Saul and his sons were killed. They abandoned their cities, and in panic they fled, and the Philistines came in and occupied those cities. Then it came about the next day when the Philistines came to strip the slain, collect all the booty, that they came across Saul and his three sons who had fallen there on Mount Gilboa. They did a gruesome thing. They cut off his head. They stripped off his weapons, and they sent them throughout the lands of the Philistines as trophies of war, carrying the good news to the house of their idols and to their people, exalting their gods over the God of Israel. They, in jubilation, put his weapons in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they fastened Saul's body to the walls of Bethshan. Some of you who, like myself, have been over there, know exactly where that is. Now, when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead, whom Saul had delivered from the Ammonites, when they heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, the valiant men of that city, Jabesh-Gilead, rose, they walked all night. They took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan, and they came to Jabesh, and they burned them there. They cremated what was left of their bodies there. And they took their bones, and they buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh, and they fasted for 7 days, representing a mourning. By the way, just this very day, had a question about cremation, whether or not we as Christians are permitted to cremate people. Well, this is not the place to go into elongated discussion of that issue, and there are various points of view which I respect, but I can tell you this much. In the Scripture, there is not a biblical position on that issue. Here is an example of cremation. That's not the preferred way, but because the sons of Saul and Saul himself had been mutilated, the head of Saul cut off, the citizens of Jabesh-Gilead felt that that was the best way to dispose of their bodies, the most honorable way under the circumstances, and that's exactly what they did. Jews and Christians have down through the centuries respected the body and have always preferred to bury the body, if the body's in any condition to bury. Of course, sometimes in great catastrophes or in war, bodies are mounted up like mounds. People have been known all over the world to burn those bodies on pyres and other things. That has no bearing on the resurrection. It does not say that there is not a resurrection or we don't believe in the resurrection. The only way that we would reject cremation, at least the only way I would, is if it were attached to a philosophy of dualism where we were saying by that act that the material body is inherently bad, as is held in Eastern religions, that the spirit is good, and that by cremating the body we were setting the spirit free from some kind of pollution. God made the body, and the body is good. So apart from a doctrine like that or some other heretical viewpoint, if it is necessary to cremate, I would have no problem cremating. My wife and I do not plan to be cremated. The Lord may return. Who knows? But we do not plan to be cremated. I have no bias in that regard, but I'm certainly not going to judge those who decide, for one reason or another, apart from some heretical theology. I'm not going to object to that. Now, others would take a little different point of view. These matters where the Bible does not speak clearly leaves room for disagreement, but that is my view, and you can take it for whatever it's worth. Now, chapter 31, then, of 1 Samuel, forms a transition to 2 Samuel chapter 1. The books were not initially divided. You should know that. So we move smoothly from 1 Samuel into the book of 2 Samuel. David learns of the Battle of Gilboa. It came about after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites that we saw in chapter 30 of the last book, that David remained for 2 days in Ziklag, what had been his home base in the time that he was with the Philistines. Now it happened on the third day that, behold, a man emerged from the camp of Saul. His clothes were torn, there's dust on his head, all ancient signals of mourning and distress. And it came about, when he came to David, the fellow fell to the ground, and he prostrated himself before David. David asked him, "Where do you come from?" He said, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." Well, now David gets the news, verse 4. David said to him, "Well, how did things go? Please tell me." And he said, "The people," meaning the people of Israel, "have fled from the battle. Also, many of the people have fallen. They're dead." And then comes the really heavy news. "Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also." Now, this fellow probably thought he was bringing good news to David. "Saul and the heir to the throne are dead," David said to the young man who told him. "Well, how do you know Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" Well, the young man who told him said, "Well, here's the deal." I'm paraphrasing. You're used to me doing this. "By chance, I happened to be on Mount Gilboa. Behold, Saul was leaning on his spear. The chariots and the horsemen were pursuing him closely. They were about ready to run him down. And when he looked behind him, he saw me, and he called out to me. I said, 'Here am I.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' And I answered," this was not a good answer, may have been true, but not with David, "he said, 'I'm an Amalekite.' Amalekites were banned by God. They were to be destroyed. He said to me, please stand beside me and kill me, for agony has seized me. In other words, gravely wounded, lethally wounded, because my life still lingers in me. I need somebody to do me in so these people won't make sport of me when they come upon me. So I stood beside him, and this Amalekite reports to David, it's a lie. He thought he was bearing David great good news, and he'd be rewarded for it. And he said, I killed him because, well, it wasn't any disrespect. You see, I knew he could not live after he'd fallen. I could see that his wound was mortal. So I took the crown which was on his head and the bracelet which are on his arm as evidence that he's dead, and I've brought them here to my Lord. Well, he got an unexpected reaction. David took hold of his clothes. David tore them, and so did all the men who were with him, diametrically opposite of what this Amalekite expected. All of a sudden, they were mourning and weeping and fasting. Fasting, a sign of mourning, an outward sign of inward mourning and distress. They fasted until evening for Saul and for his son Jonathan and for the people of the Lord of the house of Israel, because it went beyond Jonathan. It was an ignominious defeat for the people of Israel and, of course, a reproach upon the name of the Lord. Well, David said to the young man who told him, where are you from? He answered, I'm the son of an alien, an Amalekite. David said to him, I want to know something. How is it you were not afraid to stretch out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? We know what a principle that was with David, how David refused to do such a thing. And David called one of the young men, and he said, he didn't even wait for the guy to answer, go, cut him down. So he was executed right there on the spot. And David said to him, your blood is on your head, for your own mouth has testified against you. I have killed the Lord's anointed. Then David chanted with a lament over Saul and Jonathan his son, and he told them to teach to the sons of Judah the song of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher. And then we have in the next 8 verses that song of the bow, which is a paean of praise and celebration to Saul and his sons. So 2 Samuel 1 picks up the narrative where 1 Samuel ends. There's a principle that establishes a connection between a leader's conduct with his eventual fate and that of his house. Those who honor God will be honored, and those who do not honor God will be dishonored in the end, if I can paraphrase. You see, folks, the spirit of a person in those revealing and testing moments of life, well, that's a pretty good indicator of whether their life will end in glory or infamy, in grace or disgrace, in honor or dishonor. In those times, what we really are, as opposed to the way we would like to appear, breaks out between the cracks of circumstances. In such times, those revelations of our character tend to be predictive of the course of our life, the direction it will take, and whether in the end it will bring us into honor or shame. This principle is illustrated here in the case of David. With Saul dead, his troubles, at least from that source, are ended. He's no longer on the lam. He's out of the long reach of his enemy, the king, and his mad state, a state induced by Saul's jealous rage. David could have been celebrating with his personal army his newfound freedom when he gets word from this Amalekite that Saul is now dead, along with Jonathan and 2 of his other sons. David could have been boasting that he was at last on track to inherit the monarchy the Lord had promised him. But what we see is none of that. Instead of gloating that his relentless enemy was dead, what we find is David grieving. Instead of seeing all the bad sides of Saul, David graciously celebrates what was good about Saul. And there had been a lot of good to come out of Saul's reign as the first king of Israel. That was because of the Lord and not because of Saul. Nevertheless, the Lord used Saul as his instrument. Certainly, the people of Israel were in a politically and militarily stronger position with their neighbors than before. Saul, as God's appointed first king, had won them some respect as their warrior king. David honored that. David honestly took the death of Saul and his sons hard, and we're meant to see that. Instead of seeing the demise of Saul as a help to himself, which indeed it was, what David sees is the larger picture. And that's somewhat an indicator of a man who's able to see the big picture instead of the small picture. One attribute of great people is their ability, in the midst of the cascade of circumstances, to keep their eye on the ball and to see things in the bigger context. And what David saw in this defeat of Israel's army at the hands of the Philistines, and what he saw most especially in the death of her mighty regent and his sons, this is the big picture. He saw the great reproach upon Israel as the people of the true living God. And therefore he saw a circumstance that defamed Israel's God in the eyes of her pagan neighbors. That is what disturbed David most. And that's what warmed the heart of God toward David. Something much greater was at stake in these sad events than clearing David's path to accession to the throne. Even if David was the one the Lord had designated to replace Saul, the Lord's anointed, there was great dishonor to God in this whole scenario. So instead of asking Israel to rally around him all of a sudden when he gets this news, the first thing David does is summon all Israel to pay tribute to Saul as the Lord's anointed and as the benefactor of the nation, not because Saul was a good or great man, but because God had made Saul what Saul became. I don't mean in his negative attributes, but in all of his positive power and influence in behalf of his nation. For all Saul's serious, even lethal faults, and his lack of a heart for God, the Lord, I say, had used Saul as his instrument to elevate his people. Therefore, instead of sullying Saul's memory, David calls upon the nation to celebrate Saul's memory. This is really noble. Instead of seeing Saul as his personal enemy, which indeed Saul had become, David honors him from the perspective that he was, in fact, the Lord's anointed. And as far as David was concerned, Saul's person and office were not to be violated or mistreated. All of this in the spirit of respect for the office, even if the man, Saul, at times proved grossly unworthy of it. Saul then may not have been a man of God. However, he was God's man at the time. I say that again, it's important. Saul may not have been a man of God, but he was God's man. A lot of people have been God's man for a time and an hour who didn't know God from a bunny rabbit. And because of that, David felt to respect and honor Saul was to respect and honor God and his sovereign appointments. You've got to admire that. So here, David is a great example of how to treat authority. Most especially, God-appointed authority, directly in this case. And the way you treat such authority was with the utmost honor, as if sacred. Political democracy, whatever its merits, does nothing much to nourish that godly spirit. I'm sorry to say that. We must understand that not everything in our national life was revealed on Mount Sinai. It is to our detriment that our system of government tends to level not only all persons, but the really bad thing is, because we level human beings, there is a tendency to be contemptuous of their offices, and from there, not only to question authority, but even to despise it. And this perverse habit molds our American spirit into such a foolish shape that we do not at times know even how to honor God. One theological perspective that aided David, I'm sure, in coping with the violent aggressiveness of Saul against himself was David's grasp of the sovereignty of God. David understood that as unpleasant and sometimes bitter as Saul's temporary role as God's man made his own life, David understood that God was in the circumstances and that God was using those circumstances for good in David's case. I mean, David didn't have a perfect grip on that. I've explained that David sometimes let fear get the better part of his faith when he went down with the Philistines. But in the main, David understood that God was the one who was really on the throne. And this is a narrative that despite all Saul's irrational fear of David and his murderous pursuit of David, this narrative displays the sincere loyalty of David to his human sovereign. It displays his loyal love to his friend Jonathan, Saul's son. And this narrative displays David's care for his slaughtered people, the people of Israel, in whom was the name and the honor of the Lord. For what the Philistines did to Israel was, in fact, a denigration of Israel's God. I have to say David's loyalty to Saul is marvelous, but again, not because of anything that was inherently in Saul, but because of what Saul represented. He represented the Lord's anointed. God had appointed Saul to his place, and as unfit as Saul proved, as long as God saw fit to keep Saul in his monarchical role, David was wise enough and understood enough to give God all the honor that was appropriate to that appointment. So he was loyal to Saul in spite of all the persecution and the injustice that David had experienced from the hand of Saul. We're all too quick to jump up in cases of authority, and some authority is really bad. We're all too quick to forget the sovereignty of God. We're all too quick to forget that God has his hidden purposes, and especially in the church, all too quick, where people may not suit us, for whatever reasons, to make up our own minds who should be where and how long, and just go kicking them aside and kicking their families aside and dumping on them. And sometimes that is just so outrageous that you just know that the Lord is going to call all that into account. David was not that kind. The Word of God teaches us to respect human authority, teaches us to respect it not for its own sake or its own merits. For, as I mentioned, human authority may not have any merit per se. But because, as we learn in Romans chapter 13, all human authority is, consciously or unconsciously, a minister or a servant of God for the purpose of promoting good, I mean God's purpose in their appointment, of promoting good and suppressing evil in this sinful world, we are obliged to respect those lines. Whatever human authorities exist, we're told in Romans 13, exist, so long as they exist, by the will of God, and are removed by the will of God, though God may not approve of the motives of those who remove them. And they will be accountable to God for that. We see that in the Old Testament, where God used people to remove unfit authorities, and then he turned around and judged those who were his instruments in doing so. Therefore, folks, remember this. To subvert or challenge human authority by unlawful means. Now catch that. By unlawful means, such as a palace coup or starting a revolution, is an attack on God's appointment and a contesting of his hidden wisdom. We celebrate a lot of those things that should never be celebrated. In a democracy, we have a different political system. And by the laws of our democracy, we have every right to go to the polls every 2 years, every 4 years, or however so often, depending on what office is in view, and offering our formal opinion of the performance of those who lead us. And by that legal process, we can elect or diselect those who are in office. And there's nothing wrong with that. And we have a legal right to voice our opinion. But we do not have the right to try to remove people from office by illegal means, and we as Christians have got to watch our tongues in the way that we treat those who are in office, for remember, those authorities that exist, whether we might understand it or not, they exist by the will of God, not because they're people who please God, but for some hidden reason in his sovereignty, God has them in those places, and we are to pray for them. I find myself remiss in that, no matter who's been in office over the years, and I have to every once in a while beat myself over the head for that lapse. Well, thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.